from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Los Angeles.
The immaturity and the clownishness of Hugo Chavez's comments were widely commented on, but nobody in the American mainstream press seems to think that Bush was being immature and clownish in talking about Iran as a part of an axis of evil.
Today, Professor Juan Cole for an extended conversation on the Middle East. But first, we go to Arlington West, the Santa Barbara Pier, where 2,700 crosses were dug in the sand to remember the 2,700 soldiers who died in Iraq. Then we look at electronic voting machines, all that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Los Angeles. The country's intelligence agencies have concluded the U.S. invasion of Iraq has increased the overall terrorist threat by spawning a new generation of Islamic radicalism. This conclusion appears in a still-classified national intelligence estimate that was completed in April. This conclusion, the one intelligence official told the New York Times, the report concluded the Iraq war has made the overall terrorism problem worse, despite contradicting claims made by the White House. The report represents a consensus view of the 16 spy agencies within the U.S. government. The NIE report is the first formal assessment of global terrorism by U.S. intelligence agencies since the invasion of Iraq. The number of U.S. military deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan has now exceeded the number of people killed in the September 11th attacks. The U.S. has lost about 2,700 troops in Iraq, another 280 in Afghanistan. This surpasses the official death toll of 9/11 of 2,973. Meanwhile, the Iraqi death toll in just July and August was over 6,600. The Washington Times is reporting the Army is studying whether to add more combat units to the rotation plan for Iraq and accelerating the deployments of some brigades. The U.S. commanders have decided to keep more than 140,000 troops in Iraq until at least next spring. This comes as the Army is requesting a 41% budget increase for the next year. On Sunday, Iraq's President Jalal Talabani asked for long-term U.S. military presence in Iraq. He said Iraq will need two permanent U.S. air bases to deter what he calls foreign interference. On Friday, Talabani spoke to the United Nations.
Our people's patience is wearing thin, particularly when we see the blood of our innocent sons and daughters being spilled and defiled, our infrastructure destroyed, our mosques and holy shrines ruined, and the rebuilding of armed forces and security forces being impeded as we try to bolster our sovereignty.
In Afghanistan, a top women's affairs official in the southern province of Kandahar has been killed. Safia Amajan was shot dead as she left her home for work. Amajan had served as the head of Kandahar's Women's Affairs Department for 5 years. She's a well-known advocate for women's rights and a critic of the Taliban. In Lebanon, hundreds of thousands of Hezbollah supporters gathered on Friday to hold what they described as a victory rally. Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah made his first appearance since the war. Nasrallah vowed not to disarm Hezbollah until the right conditions were in place. He said the steadfastness of Hezbollah had foiled the U.S. plan to create a so-called new Middle East. A prosecutor in Germany has told Newsweek he's conducting a probe into the CIA's officials involved in the kidnapping of Khaled al-Masri. Al-Masri is the German citizen who was seized by the CIA in Macedonia and flown to a jail in Afghanistan. He was wrongly suspected of involvement with 9/11 conspirators. A Spanish newspaper has published the names of 20 CIA agents and contractors believed to have been involved. They include Eric Farrell, Baron James Ferning and Kirk James Byrd, all three apparently work for the North Carolina company Aero Contractors, which has been identified as a possible CIA front company. A French newspaper has reported that it's seen a French intelligence memo that claims Osama bin Laden died last month in Pakistan of typhoid. The report has been met with widespread skepticism. The Saudi and Pakistani governments have said they have no evidence, in fact, that bin Laden is dead. Bin Laden was also the subject of a heated interview with former President Clinton on Fox News. Chris Wallace asked Clinton if he had done enough to capture bin Laden.
I worked hard to try to kill him. I authorized the finding for the CIA to kill him. We contracted with people to kill him. I got closer to killing him than anybody's gotten since. And if I were still president, we'd have more than 20,000 troops there trying to kill him. Now, I've never criticized President Bush, and I don't think this is useful. But you know, we do have a government that thinks Afghanistan is only one-seventh as important as Iraq.
President Clinton went on to criticize the Bush administration for not focusing on bin Laden during the 8 months prior to the September 11th attacks.
Do you think you did enough, sir?
No, because I didn't get him.
Right.
But at least I tried. That's the difference in me and some, including all the right-wingers that are attacking me now. They ridicule me for trying. They had 8 months to try. They did not try. I tried. So I tried and failed. When I failed, I left a comprehensive anti-terror strategy, and the best guy in the country, Dick Clark, who got demoted. So you did Fox's bidding on this show. You did your nice little conservative hit job on me.
At the United Nations, Egypt has criticized the United States and other Western powers for blocking efforts to declare Israel's nuclear arsenal a threat. Egypt's foreign minister, Ahmed Abouelghait, said, quote, "It's unacceptable that these countries continue to ignore the danger posed by the Israeli nuclear threat to stability and security in the Middle East." ExxonMobil is being accused of spreading inaccurate and misleading information about climate change by financing groups that misinform the public on the issue. The British scientific group Royal Society criticized the oil company for sending nearly $3 million last year to groups like the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Meanwhile, the Natural Resources Council of Maine has released a new report on how global warming could impact Maine's coastline, one historic site considered to be at extreme risk of being submerged underwater is the Bush family compound in Kennebunkport. The Department of Homeland Security has awarded the defense contractor Boeing a $67 million contract to build a virtual fence along the U.S. borders with Mexico and Canada. The virtual fence will utilize sensors, camera, and drones to monitor the border. Last week, the House of Representatives voted to build a 700-mile physical fence along the U.S.-Mexico border. The number of journalists killed for their work has reached 580 over the last 15 years. The study by the Committee to Protect Journalists found 7 out of every 10 journalists killed were targeted in retaliation for their reporting and were hunted down to be murdered. Tensions between the United States and Venezuela continue to rise. Last week, U.S. officials detained Venezuela's foreign minister, Nicolas Maduro, at JFK Airport as he traveled home. Maduro says he was verbally abused and strip-searched. The Bush administration initially claimed the incident did not happen. The African Union has announced plans to send more troops into Sudan to reinforce its peacekeeping mission in Darfur. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice called the Sudanese government to uphold the peace agreement.
The violence in Darfur must end, and it must end now. The Darfur peace agreement, signed in May, provides a political framework to end the conflict and to open a path to peace, freedom, and opportunity for the people of Darfur. The future of this agreement, however, is now at risk. The government of Sudan has launched a military offensive, and the security situation in Darfur is deteriorating.
In Italy, over 20 people have been arrested after the discovery of an illegal spy operation that targeted high-level politicians, business leaders, and journalists. Among the arrested was the former chief of security for Telecom Italia. The suspects were accused of spying on a wide range of personalities, tapping their phones, gathering bank and legal records and other sensitive data. Italy's justice minister said the spy operation amounted to an attack on democracy. The Bush administration is being urged to restrict the export of high-tech surveillance equipment to China. The Electronic Privacy Information Center says U.S. companies like Oracle, Zoco, and Motorola have sold technology products to Chinese police and security that could help them track political dissidents. Meanwhile, here in this country, the chair of Hewlett-Packard, Patricia Dunn, has resigned as new details emerge about how the company spied on journalists as well as members of its board. The company hired private investigators to obtain the phone records of journalists, and the company considered planting spies in the newsrooms of The Wall Street Journal and CNET. In Puerto Rico, thousands gathered Saturday to mark the first anniversary of the FBI's killing of independence leader Filiberto Ojeda Rios. The September 23rd rally also marked Grito de Lares, a holiday to commemorate the day Puerto Ricans rebelled to demand independence from Spain. Meanwhile, the ACLU of Puerto Rico has sued the FBI for beating and macing 20 Puerto Rican journalists earlier this year. The incident occurred when the journalists attempted to cover the FBI raid in the home of a prominent pro-independence activist, Lilian Lavoy. Anti-war protests are continuing across the country this week as part of Declaration of Peace Week. On Thursday, 34 religious leaders, veterans, and peace movement activists were arrested at the White House. In Maine, 11 protesters were arrested after refusing to leave the Bangor office of Senator Olympia Snowe. 9 more protesters were arrested in Portland, Oregon, at Senator Gordon Smith's office. On Saturday, 37 people were arrested at the Indian Island Naval Base near Port Townsend, Washington. Over 350 communities are holding protests and vigils to mark the Declaration of Peace Week, which began on Thursday. In other news, Louis Farrakhan has announced he is seriously ill. The 73-year-old leader of the Nation of Islam made the announcement in a letter on Friday. And finally, the labor activist and singer Joe Glazer has died at the age of 88. In 1950, he was the first singer to record a version of the civil rights anthem, We Shall Overcome. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from Los Angeles. Last evening, as we drove to Santa Barbara, we pulled up to the pier. There we saw thousands of crosses dug into the beach. We talked to the man who started this, what is called Arlington West. His name is Stephen Sherrill, and he is with Veterans for Peace.
It started November 2nd of 2003 with about 340 crosses. It was designed for two purposes. One, a memorial to recognize the kids that have lost their lives over in Iraq, and also a wake-up call for Americans to show them the terrible price that we have paid for this war in Iraq.
Talk about the numbers here.
Today we just hit 2,700 crosses. The average number of soldiers dying has been about 14 per week, about 2 per day. The last 4 weeks, we've been above our average. We had 16 this week. We had 23 the week before, and 23 the week before that.
And how have people responded to this display?
Well, we've been here almost 3 years now, and we have noticed a clear shift in the sentiment of the visitors that come here. In the beginning, we used to get a lot of people that would shout at us and call us communists and terrorist sympathizers, but we have definitely noticed a shift in the sentiment of the American people. We get almost no derogatory comments now at all.
Stephen Sherrill, he is with Veterans for Peace, and he is the founder of Arlington West at the Santa Barbara Pier. We spoke to him last night in Santa Barbara as we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour, traveling to 80 cities on this 10th anniversary of Democracy Now! Today we head to Scripps College in Claremont, and then we'll fly to Salt Lake City and celebrate KRCL, the community radio station there. We'll then go on to Boise, Idaho on Tuesday at noon, and in the evening we'll be in Boulder, Colorado. Then we'll head to New Mexico, to Santa Fe, Albuquerque, and Taos. But right now, we're going to turn back to an interview I did on Friday when we stopped in Ann Arbor and we broadcast from the University of Michigan. There we spoke to Juan Cole. He's professor of Middle Eastern history. I asked him about the situation in Iraq.
A United Nations report on Iraq, which was extremely disturbing. There was a 15% increase in deaths reported in Baghdad in July and August, nearly 7,000 dead between the 2 months, up from May and June, which were already horrible. 90% of these deaths seem to be death squad killings. People show up dead in the streets in the morning. The United Nations talked about torture. The bodies show signs of acid, chemicals, drills into joints, into the head. It's horrible.
The UN Rapporteur on Torture says the situation is worse now than under Saddam Hussein.
Well, I think it's difficult to quantify these things. My own feeling is that if you averaged out the deaths attributed to the Ba'ath Party from 1968 to 2003, up until February or so, the average was still about the same. There seemed to be an average rate of horrible death and torture in Iraq. But in the last 6 months, since the Golden Dome at Samarra was blown up, a Shiite shrine that provoked death squads to attack Sunnis in revenge. Since that time, and of course then there have been Sunni reprisals, the rate of killing has increased alarmingly.
And what do you see as the cause right now?
Well, there's a behind the scenes, late at night in the alleyways, a civil war going on between Shiites, Iraqis, and Sunni Arabs. This is a war that has many dimensions. It is a turf war. It's about ethnically cleansing neighborhoods, controlling territory. It's about a rivalry over control of resources, including petroleum smuggling and antiquity smuggling, other kinds of smuggling. It is a political contest to position themselves for when the Americans leave. But it is, it's certainly at this rate of death, a civil war.
Civil war.
Without any doubt.
Unqualified.
Unqualified.
Sectarian civil war.
Well, it is sectarian in some places in the sense that it's between two religious groups, the Sunni Arabs and the Shiites. It's not always being fought on religious grounds alone. And there are places like Kirkuk where it's ethnic. It's between Arabs and Kurds or between Turkmen and Kurds. So it is multidimensional. If you can find an ethnic marker between two Iraqis that's different, it can be the basis for violence right now.
What about daily life right now for Iraqis? What is a day like?
Yeah. Well, of course, it's a big country, and so it differs very much from city to city, from region to region. If you were up north in the Kurdistan region, Erbil, Dohuk, Suleymaniya, it's good times. It's economic boom. They're building suburbs. There's a Disneyland at Suleymaniya. You can't tell from what people tell me that anything is going on. But if you move south slightly to Kirkuk, there are bombings, there are assassinations, there's ethnic tension. If you move on down to Mosul, there are entire neighborhoods apparently that are controlled by the guerrilla movement. And then as you come down to Baghdad and Ramadi, it's truly horrible. There's a feeling of no security. Shops have difficulty opening. They're often closed. They close up at 2 if they are open. There have been reports that the bustling, famous book market in Watanabe Street is a ghost town. Nobody goes there, and the people are afraid to go out.
Are the parliamentary leaders continuing to meet?
Parliamentary leaders meet, but in the green zone, which is to say behind concrete barriers and behind marine guards. In this summer, Grand Ayatollah Sistani complained bitterly that 60% of them were out of the country. It's just safer to be in London. He said, you can't run a legislature like that. And so the meetings of parliament often have 100 parliamentarians missing. That's par for the course. And they do meet, they do try to hammer out agreements, but they don't have much power. They don't have the ability to give commands and have them obeyed for the most part. Some of them are party leaders or militia leaders in their own right, and they have a little more power. But apparently they're losing control of the grassroots. There was fighting in the city of Diwania not so long ago. By Mahdi army militiamen against the local Shiite government. Muqtada Sadr's people say he didn't order it. That was something that the local leader decided to get into. Well, it means he's not in control of the Mahdi army in Diwania, and I think that's typical now. Iraq is becoming more and more fractured.
What do the sides want?
Well, in a way, it's what they don't want. The Sunni Arabs don't want to be completely dominated by the Shiite religious parties, whom they code as being very close to Iran, and by the Kurds. The Sunni Arabs are afraid that essentially they'll be cut out of the deal. They don't have natural resources in their part of the country. In West and North Iraq. They don't have petroleum fields. There's a big field around Kirkuk, which is in Kurdish-controlled territory. There's a big field down at Rumaila in South Iraq that the Shiites control. And the Shiites and the Kurds increasingly are moving towards semi-autonomy. I mean, this is almost like, you know, remember when the Soviet Union broke up, that for a while they said, well, we'll still be together somehow. It'll be the Commonwealth of Independent States. Well, Iraq is moving towards being a commonwealth of independent provinces. And the Sunni Arabs are afraid that this movement by the Shiites and the Kurds will leave them high and dry. The Shiites resent deeply the violence that the Sunni Arabs have resorted to in order to prevent the Shiites from coming to power, from exercising that power, from moving towards greater autonomy from the central government. You know, the Sunni Arab guerrilla groups have been horrible in their tactics. They'll bomb a wedding in a city like Hilla, and then they know that evening in Islamic law you immediately have the funeral. They'll come back and bomb the funeral that evening, hit the same group of people again. So if that happens every week for a while all around the country, eventually people just hate each other. Hmm.
We're talking to Professor Juan Cole here at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. In fact, we're sitting in a classroom. You talk about the Kurds. BBC's reporting that Israel's training the Kurds.
Well, BBC's reporting that there is an Israeli company or two that's been giving training to Kurds using ex-special ops forces. These are private security guards now who are giving training. And
not at the behest of the Israeli government?
Well, we don't know exactly.
Or proxy.
We don't know exactly what is the relationship. There have been rumored to be good relations between the Kurdish regional government and the Israelis for some time. There have been earlier reports by Sy Hirsch of Israeli intelligence agents operating in Kurdistan. In fact, spying on Iran from Kurdistan. If special ops Israeli security companies are providing training to the Kurdish Peshmerga, this is not a huge surprise. It would violate Iraqi law. But the Kurdistan increasingly is not operating under Iraqi law. They give out their own visas. They invite foreign companies to come and do prospecting without telling Baghdad. They recently have decided they're not going to fly the Iraqi flag anymore. I mean, you have an independent country here that has its own army. It says the federal troops may never step foot on Kurdish soil. Iraq has become for the Kurds a mere fig leaf. They are doing whatever they want to do, and they don't want to anger Iran and Turkey to the extent of provoking hostilities, so they don't declare independence, but they are operating as though they are independent in all but name.
The Iranian president said in New York when he was at the United Nations that his government doesn't need a nuclear weapon, is open to negotiations on suspending nuclear activities. Your assessment of where this all stands?
Well, the Iranian government has all along maintained that it's not trying to get a nuclear weapon. Supreme jurisprudent Ali Khamenei, who is the theocrat of Iran and sets law, says that atomic bombs are immoral in Islamic law. You can't use them because they inevitably kill large numbers of innocent civilians, which is contrary to the rules for waging war in Islam. It can only be waged properly against combatants. And so Khamenei has forbidden atomic weapons. The Iranian government has all along maintained that it has no weapons program. And no weapons program has been found. The International Atomic Energy Agency is frustrated that the Iranians haven't always been transparent. They haven't declared all of their experiments. There are facilities that haven't allowed visits to. And so there are suspicions as to why all this should be and what the Iranians are up to. But the report says they haven't been able to testify that there is a weapons program. So President Ahmadinejad said was consistent with Iranian policy all along.
Professor Juan Cole teaches at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. We'll come back to a conversation. We'll talk about whether Iran is developing nuclear weapons in a minute. Bombs Over Fallujah by Black Mona Lisa here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Los Angeles today. We did this interview on Friday at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, where I spoke with Professor Juan Cole. I asked him about a new controversial congressional report that alleges that Iran is further ahead in the development of nuclear weapons than previously believed. I asked him if this is similar to the misinformation campaign in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq.
I think there's enormous amounts of hype coming out of Washington and out of John Bolton's office at the UN about Iran. Allegations are constantly made. In fact, the news media tend to fall into this trap because Iran does have a nuclear energy research program, which is permitted under the terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which they are signatories. And they do have inspections. They have regular inspections. Those inspections have not been completely satisfactory. But no country that's been under the NPT has ever developed nuclear weapons. Iran, it's a little bit mysterious. Why would they sign on to this if they were, in fact, violating it? Why not just—there's nothing that requires you to join. India didn't. And Pakistan developed a bomb. And these were permitted to India and Pakistan. That's another question is to, you know, it's a dangerous neighborhood. Israel has several hundred nuclear weapons and has brandished them threatened neighbors with them.
Ahmadinejad doesn't raise that very much, actually, does he?
No, Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad does. I mean, he does talk about the hypocrisy but it's because he's saying we're not trying to get them in the first place. So that's not his argument. The people who raised the hypocrisy argument about Israel's arsenal and now India and Pakistan's, which all seem to be just fine with Washington. There's no crisis about that. The people who raised that mostly are the Egyptians and the Saudis and the Arab world, which would like a nuclear-free zone. They don't want Iran having nuclear weapons. They wish that Israel would give its up. They're not enthusiastic about India and so forth. So it's become an increasingly dangerous neighborhood. And the argument is made in Washington that there are vents somewhere in these facilities that show that there are deep bunker facilities that we don't know about, that they're up to something. And then allegations are made that the Iranian state is peopled by crazy people. The argument is, it's a frankly racist argument, that you're dealing with madmen here, and therefore they may not be allowed to get nuclear weapons. Well, I mean, I'm against proliferation myself. I think it's better that fewer countries that have these things, the better off the whole world is. But the Iranian state hasn't invaded aggressively another country for 200 years. It hasn't demonstrated itself to be peopled by wild men. And it is an authoritarian government, and one can criticize it on various grounds, but it's not been an aggressive government. It's not like Saddam Hussein.
Professor Cole, Ahmadinejad's comments have come up again as he comes to the United States about denying the Holocaust.
Yes, Ahmadinejad is a Holocaust denier. He has a thing about Jews and Israel and the Holocaust that comes across very clearly when he talks about it. It's a kind of paranoia or fixation, Ahmadinejad is not a really educated man. He's got an engineering degree. He's from what we call the Bazaari class. This is people who, from a shopkeeping background, or hung around at mosques and kind of self-educated and so forth. So he's not a man of the world. His predecessor, President Mohammed Khatami, lived in Germany for 7 years and has written using the German sociologist Jürgen Habermas's theories of civil society. Khatami has written on dialogue of civilizations and open society and so forth, and has reprimanded Ahmadinejad for his bizarre statements about the Holocaust. So this is not an Iranian government stance or an Iranian stance. This is something that's peculiar to Ahmadinejad. And remember, the Iranian president is powerless, virtually. The commander-in-chief of the armed forces is Khamenei, the supreme jurisprudent. Ahmadinejad can consult on the appointment of cabinet ministers and ambassadors, but there are very few orders that he could give of any significance in the Iranian system. He's kind of like our Secretary of the Interior or something. So what he thinks about things isn't that important.
Professor Juan Cole, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, has slammed a Republican report on Iran and nuclear weapons.
Well, there is a congressional report on Iran, which came out and was extremely sloppy and made all kinds of false allegations. Well, there's a caption at one point that says that Iran is enriching uranium to weapons grade. And there is no evidence of that whatsoever. Indeed, you know, people don't know the technicalities of it, and I'm not an expert on it myself, but I do know the Iranians are using small refrigerator-sized centrifuges. They have about 164 of them to enrich uranium for energy purposes. And that's a whole different deal than if you were making a weapon. If you were making a weapon, you would need 16,000 centrifuges, and they'd have to be hooked up in a special way that they do something called cascading, so that the fissionable material has the right the right form for making a bomb. Well, the Iranians don't have 16,000 centrifuges. They have 164, and they say that they've managed to enrich to 2.5%. You need to enrich to something like 80% in order to make a weapon. And being able to enrich to the amount needed to make fuel is a different order of magnitude.
Who wrote the Republican report?
Well, it was actually written by a staffer named Feitz, who used to work for John Bolton. And this kind of use of false allegations against Iran and innuendo and intimations that they've got a weapons program and it's far advanced. This is typical of Bolton and the far right wing of the Republican Party.
Mm. A lot was made of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez talking about President Bush as a devil. Can you talk about President Bush's language over time?
Well, my argument is that Bush started this with his use of the phrase axis of evil in his 2002 State of the Union address, and I think it's shameful. I think that we are a secular country. Our law does not, in fact, our law forbids the government from favoring any particular religion. Or for favoring religion over secular people. And the use of the word evil or devil, these are theological terms. Personally, I don't believe in a personal Satan. And I resent my elected officials dragging me into a discourse about the world in which whole countries are made satanic. And what does that mean? It means you can't talk to them, they're evil, you can't sit down with them and negotiate. It takes diplomacy off the table. And once you take diplomacy off the table, what's left? Ultimatums and war. So this absolutist language, this theological language, drags the secular republic into being a warmongering theological state, just in the essence of it. And Bush, when he starts calling other countries and leaders evil, well, aren't they going to do the same thing to him? Isn't the immaturity and the clownishness of Hugo Chavez's comments were widely commented on, but nobody in the American mainstream press seems to think that Bush was being immature and clownish in talking about Iran as a part of an axis of evil.
And the term Islamofascism?
Well, the term Islamofascism is a form of bigotry. It is an attempt to tie a great religious tradition to which a very substantial portion of humanity belongs and has belonged through the last millennium to a Western secular political tendency, the fascist movement of the 1930s, which, by the way, wasn't influential in the Middle East among the Middle Eastern masses. And the intellectuals in Cairo denounced it. And it's just horrible to tie Islam and the Quran and the ideals of the Islamic religion to try to tie them to Hitler and Mussolini. If somebody were to do this, to Christianity or Judaism, there would be an enormous outcry. But it's all right to do it to Muslims.
What about Egypt right now and the statements of the President Mubarak's son?
Well, Gamal Mubarak is very potentially the successor in Egypt. They are republics in the Arab world, but sometimes they have an almost monarchical succession. Bashar al-Assad in Syria succeeded to Hafez al-Assad. So a lot of people think that Gamal is being positioned to take over when his father steps down. Hosni Mubarak, the leader of Egypt, has presided over a long period of political stability in the country, but he is 78, and there will be a transition in the near future. Gamal now has come out and said that Egypt needs civilian nuclear energy. And has been carrying out off and on small experiments, and that this may get revved up. And he also came out and rejected the Bush administration's ideas for the Greater Middle East, which is a code word for U.S. Imposing in various ways through pressure or military action what it calls democracy on the region. Mubarak represents a tradition in Egypt of military rule, but in business suits, but basically it's a military government, and which puts a limit on where society can go. And they are very afraid that one person, one vote, free and open politics might lead to the Muslim Brotherhood, a fundamentalist a religious trend, which has authoritarian tendencies, might take over the country. And so he's very much against going too far in what Bush calls democratization, and he's rejected it.
Israel and Lebanon, the Arab League is now pushing a new proposal called the Beirut Compromise or proposal.
Well, the problem with the situation between Israel and Lebanon is that the war was inconclusive. The Israelis didn't get what they were looking for, and neither, I think, did the Hezbollah. Lebanon is a very divided society, and it has been badly hit. It's probably been set back in its economic development 20 years. Towards the end of the war, the Israelis released, it is estimated, up to 1 million cluster bombs in the south. A lot of cluster bombs don't explode. So there are these bombs lying around all through the South Lebanon that children will pick up, and already a dozen people have died from them. And this is a war crime, quite frankly. Hezbollah committed war crimes during the war in targeting civilian cities like Haifa in a random sort of way, and Amnesty International has denounced them, and that's true. But this is a massive war crime to let loose this number of cluster bombs in South Lebanon.
Estimates of what, up to 350,000?
Even more. It was done in the last days of the war. So it wasn't even being done for obvious military purposes. This was a political act. It was an attempt to make South Lebanon inhospitable to human habitation, which is a violation of the Geneva Conventions and simple ordinary morality. And of course, it wouldn't work. The Lebanese farmers are going to go back to their farms, and if there are cluster bombs, then they'll just have to try to deal with them. So there was a mindset during this war of punitiveness towards the whole Lebanese public. It wasn't a war just with Hezbollah. They took out bridges up at Junia, which is a Christian port. They hit Tripoli port. They bombed Ashrafia, a Christian area of Beirut. They bombed the airport. The whole country was attacked, not just the Hezbollah. And it was an attempt to turn the Lebanese against one another, and it didn't work. The Lebanese, although they have their differences, had a civil war, and they know what that is, and they weren't going to have another one to please the Israelis.
How has the war between Israel and Lebanon changed the political landscape of the Middle East?
Well, it has definitely weakened Israel's position. Israel is the regional superpower in that part of the world. It's the only nuclear power in the Middle East. It had been known to easily defeat Arab armies. In 1967, even in 1973, where they were surprised, they riposted quite well. And they marched into Beirut in 1982 with very little trouble. So this is the first time that they've launched a military push of this sort. And failed in their war aims. They were stymied by Hezbollah. Merkava tanks, their armor was penetrated by Hezbollah RPGs. The Hezbollah seems to have been able to listen in on some of their communications, and therefore to know their plans.
Is Ehud Olmert going to survive?
Well, I think that he'll survive. There's not very much of an alternative. If Labor hadn't been so stupid as to enter this unity government, and Amir Peretz hadn't been so stupid as to offer to become the defense minister, then Labor could have positioned itself as able to do a better job. But in a way, Labor was tainted as well.
Which leaves?
Which doesn't leave much. I mean, people have turned away from the Likud party, only got 9 seats. And so that's why I say, I mean, I think the government will limp along just because there's nothing obvious to replace it with. But Olmert has certainly been weakened.
You survey the Arab press. How does it compare to the U.S.?
Well, it's like night and day. In the Arab world, the first value people are looking for is local independence. And they judge everything that happens by how it affects their local independence. It's kind of an analogy to people who are concerned about states' rights in the United States. So they want the federal government being in their business in a big way. Well, for the Arab world and for the Middle East generally, the United States is like the federal government. I mean, it is a presence in everybody's lives. It shapes people's policies. It shapes their lives, their culture, and so forth. And so from their point of view, you know, there was never any question, for the most part, in the Arab world, outside Iraq, that the American presence in Iraq would be bad for people. And the opinion polls all showed this. And they felt, you know, they had a long experience with European powers coming in and ruling them, the French in Algeria and the British in Egypt and so forth. And it always seemed to them a bad deal. So they had no question that the Iraq misadventure would go bad, and so they're not surprised at all that it has. And from their point of view, the Lebanon war was an act of naked, unbridled Israeli, unprovoked aggression on the whole country of Lebanon. It wasn't, as the Western press depicts it, the natural reaction of the Israelis to their soldiers being attacked and kidnapped. So it's a completely different point of view on the world that is in the region. It's one that is very little heard and can be very little heard in the Western media. And it's unfortunate. It means that there's a discourse in the United States that's different from the discourse in the Middle East. Indeed, different from the discourse in Europe. I mean, the United States is a peculiarly insular society in which the reference points are very much internal. If a Republican senator or congressman isn't saying something, then it's very difficult to say it and have it be heard aside from on Democracy Now!
Professor Juan Cole, he teaches history at the University of Michigan and runs the website Inform Comment about the latest developments in Iraq. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to look at voting machines with the London Independent's Andrew Gumbel. We're broadcasting from Hollywood. Stay with us.
Thank you for joining us live on the air.
My pleasure.
One nation under God has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV, its satellite links are United States of unconsciousness. Apathetic, therapeutic, and extremely addictive. The methadone metronome, pumping out 150 channels 24 hours a day. You can flip through all of them, and still there's nothing worth watching. TV is a reason why less than 10% of our nation reads books daily. Why most people think Central America means Kansas. Socialism means un-American, and apartheid is a new headache remedy.
Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy. We're listening to Disposable Heroes, Television Drug of the Nation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Hollywood, California. As we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour, we turn now to the continuing controversy over electronic voting machines. Last week, the governor of Maryland called for the scrapping of the electronic voting system and reverting to paper ballots for the upcoming November election. Governor Robert Ehrlich said such a move is needed because of technical glitches that occurred in the state's primary election earlier this month. In that election, electronic voting machines that were built by Diebold repeatedly crashed. Andrew Gumbel is with us now in the studio. He writes for the London Independent. His book, though, is called Steal This Vote. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. Talk about the situation in Maryland right now.
Well, the Maryland primary earlier this month was a complete disaster. The state is run entirely on Diebold electronic voting machines. And they introduced a new element this time around, which was something called e-poll books, which was an electronic form of managing the data lists of the voters themselves. And marrying that list with the process of getting people to vote individually turned out to be a major headache. On top of that, there were a number of huge bureaucratic mistakes, the most glaring one being in Montgomery County in suburban D.C., where the elections administrator forgot to include the smart cards in the packs that he sent out to the precincts, so effectively the machines were unusable. Voters were then given an emergency backup alternative of voting on paper, but the paper ballots ran out way too soon. The whole thing was just horrible. And this, you know, is a symptom of a couple of things. One is that these machines are largely untested and can't be relied upon in a live election situation. And the other is that training poll workers and precinct officers to use these machines is a challenge greater than is reasonable in most circumstances. You know, Maryland is a very well-educated state. There are plenty of people available who are willing to conduct elections, and yet they've made a complete mess of it. The other very interesting thing that's going on is the governor, Robert Ehrlich, who's a Republican, came forward and said, let's scrap these machines and let's vote on paper in November. As a matter of practicality, that's not going to happen because it's just not nearly enough time for that kind of shift to occur and for the election to run smoothly in November. But what's really interesting is it shows that the popular mood has shifted significantly and decisively away from electronic voting machines. And it's not just in Maryland. Across the country, where voters are given the choice, which they are in some precincts, between voting on an electronic touchscreen machine and a regular paper ballot that's then optically scanned, they are opting overwhelmingly for the paper option. Which suggests they don't trust the electronic machinery, they don't believe their vote's going to be counted properly. In some cases, there are complaints that they don't find the interface user-friendly for a number of reasons. This is a huge shift, from a couple of years ago where the mantra was, you know, computers are going to save elections in this country, and that's been demonstrated now not to be the case.
For a long time, Diebold was associated with Republican politics based in Ohio, the head of it, the former head of it, saying that he was going to deliver the votes to George Bush. But you're describing here in Maryland, it's the Republican governor who's saying, let's do away with it. How did Diebold come to Maryland?
Diebold came to Maryland because of, you know, in party political terms, it was Democrats who pushed this through. It was a Secretary of State, John Willis, who was a Democrat, and it was the Maryland State Legislature that approved it. Most damningly, actually, and most embarrassingly for Maryland, they commissioned a technical study in 2002 to find out the feasibility of using electronic voting, and the experts they consulted all came back and said, we're not ready for this. And they ignored that completely, made an initial purchase of $13 million. The following summer, 2 days after a group of computer scientists from around the country examined the Diebold software and found that it was riddled with security problems, 2 days after that, they approved an even bigger purchase of $55 million. I think they're now up to $106 million worth of investment in Diebold machinery. And there's been one study after another, a couple commissioned by the state of Maryland itself, and several since that have repeatedly shown that the software is not properly written, that security is not only inadequate, it's really not taken as a proper consideration, and on and on and on. And, you know,
is Diebold, is Maryland the only all Diebold state?
It's one of two. The other one is Georgia, where, interestingly, it was also a Democratic political structure that approved it. My point in the book is that, you know, the real problem, some people have come to believe because of the political affiliation of the heads of the voting machine companies that this is a specifically Republican problem, that it's Republicans that are somehow in cahoots with Diebold to defraud the voters. My argument in the book is if you look at the history of how this works, and if you look at what's going on now, the real enemy, as it were, is the two-party system, that neither party in the end is really interested in protecting the transparency and fairness of elections. What they're interested in is promoting their own political power base, and in the case of some of these officials in Georgia and Maryland and elsewhere, they believe they can make their careers by introducing electronic voting, and they didn't care that they hadn't done their homework properly and made sure these systems would work. And now it's coming back to bite them. In Georgia, Kathy Cox, the Secretary of State, wanted to run for governor. She was knocked out of that race in the Democratic primary. Other parts of the country, you're seeing in Maryland now that the politically savvy thing to do is to be against these machines, not for them.
The Democratic Congressman Holt, who's introduced year after year this legislation to have just a receipt, a paper record of the vote, where is that standing in all of this?
It's pretty much stalled, but it doesn't matter too much because it's been going state by state. And now you have a situation where in roughly half the states there is either legislation that's been passed or is on the verge of being passed that would authorize some kind of audit trail, paper audit trail for these machines. It's not completely unproblematic because if you don't oblige the voter to look at the paper trail, and if that paper trail is badly produced by the companies on thermal paper that fades very quickly, you have a situation where you don't know if you can trust the paper trail either, which is very unsatisfactory. And what you need is one of two things. You either need to vote on paper in the first place, which is what the paper ballots that are then optically scanned, that system does. And everybody agrees who's looked at this, that's the safest system available on the market at the moment. Or you need to come up with a new machine where the computer would not just record the votes, but would actually generate a paper ballot that would be the ballot that could then be verified and checked afterwards if necessary.
You have an upcoming piece in The Nation magazine on voting. Can you talk about, well, perhaps the place most famous for voting scandals, Florida?
That's right. And I went and spent a couple of days in Leon County in Tallahassee, the state capital, where the local elections administrator, Ion Sancho, who's been on your show, is really one of the few, if not the only, election administrator in the country who really takes his job seriously and does it properly. And as a result, he's been subject to considerable harassment by the state authorities and by the voting machine companies themselves, who earlier this year tried to freeze him out by refusing to sell to him. He overcame that. But what's very interesting in Florida and what he's up against is that the state legislature, which is in Republican hands, has passed a number of very restrictive changes to the election law that either provide for partisan advantage for the Republicans in one way or another, or have made the process much less transparent, or both. So, for example, you know, they said after 2000 in Florida, never again do we want this kind of a mess with having to recount the votes and all this controversy about recounts. What they have done is effectively made manual recounts impossible in Florida now. The only kind of recounts that are authorized at all is if in a very close race they're going to look at the overvotes, which is when people appear to have marked their ballots more than once in a race, or undervotes where they appear not to have marked their ballots at all, which is a very small fraction of the votes. And they're only going to look at those. They're not going to look at the rest of the votes. So effectively, recounts have been outlawed in Florida, which is really stunning. And it's not the only state that has taken measures like that. It may be the most extreme, but in Ohio, for example, it's much, much harder now to conduct recounts than it was before. This is very disturbing for anybody who cares about voting rights, regardless of which party you support.
Andrew Gumbel, why would a Brit like you be interested or care so much about the voting machines of the United States?
I think because, you know, the United States has this reputation for being this towering democracy, and when you come here and see what it looks like in practice, it's really shocking. And the other thing is, I don't think most Americans until relatively recently had the slightest notion of how appallingly badly the system was run. And, you know, I've been in other parts of the world and been interested in pro-democracy movements. You come here and see this going on, and it just was something that I was drawn to, and no one else was writing about it that much. So
do you see any hope in terms of this being improved?
I do, because I think people are becoming educated very fast. You have incredible energy among activist groups around the country on a very local level, sometimes at county level, sometimes at state level, and they are absolutely passionate about this. I was in Tennessee not so long ago where there's a group in Nashville that is absolutely on top of this, and they've come to understand that it's not about blaming the Republicans in the state, it's about getting ordinary Republican voters and ordinary Democratic voters together and to say to each other, we need a fair system for the sake of all of us. And that kind of shift of thinking is now going on, and I find that very encouraging.
Andrew Gumbel, I want to thank you very much for being with us. His book is called Steal This Vote, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. That does it for today's broadcast. We continue on our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour today at 10 a.m. in California. We'll be at Balch Auditorium, Scripps College, Claremont, California. Tonight at 7:30, we'll be in Salt Lake City at Salt Lake Community College Grand Theater, 7:30. Tomorrow at noon, Student Union, Boise State University in Boise, Idaho. Tomorrow night, we'll be at Boulder, Colorado, First United Methodist Church, and then we'll be in Santa Fe. That does it for today's broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Hope Dokadoos, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuriko Richin, Aaron Maté, Frank Lopez, Jen Utes. Special thanks to Chuck Skurich. I'm Amy Goodman, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.